From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with the majority leader of the Virginia Senate, Dick Saslaw. But our first victim today, our first guest today is Kenyon McDuffie. He's a D.C. council member representing Ward 5. Councilmember McDuffie, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me again, Kojo.
Before we speak with the council member directly, Tom Sherwood, exactly what is going on with the Purple Line? A Maryland judge has apparently ruled that this PPP agreement is allowed to fall apart. And that is a public-private partnership in which the private partners have said, we no longer want in on this. We want to get out of this. At first, it was thought that they couldn't. Now a judge has ruled that they can. And it puts the future of the Purple Line, it seems, in jeopardy, does it not?
Yes, and as of Monday, this partnership can get out. But, you know, this Purple Line should be called the Black and Blue Line. It has been beaten up from the time it was proposed. And when then new Governor Larry Hogan came in, he gutted state funding for it, taking hundreds of millions of dollars out of the pot for it, forcing Montgomery and Prince George's to pay more. And then all along, the state agreed to this contract, picking up for the lowest bidder. And now we've seen the result of that. Work is being done. You drive around like I did up in Silver Spring and other areas where the Purple Line is being built. There's traffic disruption, holes in the ground. And at this point, unless the state and the partners can renegotiate this thing and put it back on track, so to speak, we may be facing years and years more of this line being built or possibly never being built. It's a real mess for the administration of Governor Hogan.
And in Washington, D.C., Mayor Muriel Bowser says that it is entirely possible that small groups can return to D.C. public schools this month. Some private and charter schools have already started doing this. She says, we don't think we can have entire school populations going to school, but maybe small groups later this month. Tom Sherwood.
This is the most optimistic the mayor has been. You know, she wanted to do a hybrid system in midsummer. She wanted to have classes some days and then homeschool the rest of the days. It was just too unwieldy. The teachers union didn't like it. And so now she's saying maybe after you get some weeks under their belt, some students can go into the classrooms. But how that would work, what teachers would be involved, what schools would be involved, what grades would be involved, all those are unanswered questions as we start this program.
The head of the union, Elizabeth Davis, says she understands that there are some teachers who are willing to go back into school. She's setting out to identify those teachers. Councilmember McDuffie, what do you think?
Well, I think I completely understand the concerns that Liz Davis raises and teachers that raise. I understand the importance of in-person instruction and the obstacles that many families and educators face as we continue to try to implement virtual learning. I think it's a delicate balance, but we've got to prioritize the safety and well-being of all our students, of their parents and families. And so I think it's important that in reopening the schools that we do so virtually. I think it was the right decision that the mayor made. I think the idea of reopening the school this month and allowing some folks to come in is ambitious, and that we should be guided by the advice of our public health officials.
Speaking of safety, this week we saw the release of a scathing report about Metro, which depicted its rail operations control center as a toxic workplace. The audit comes from an independent commission, the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission. It detailed racial and sexual harassment and managers ordering employees to ignore regulations. You sit on the D.C. Council's Transportation Committee. What do you think of these revelations, and what do you think needs to be done about these problems? Are not only employees, but riders at risk here?
Well, I am deeply concerned about the report, and some of the things that came out of that report are troubling. The Metro Safety Commission's reports of employees being bullied, racially and sexually harassed. There were reports that some people were told by managers to ignore authorities and operating procedures. I mean, if these things are true, it represents a clearly unsafe workplace and warrants immediate attention and focus to fix this and turn it around. I think it really, Metro needs to inspire confidence in all that they do, given how linked our local economy is to safe public transit. And so I think, unfortunately, Metro has a very recent history and a troubling history of some issues. I think we all remember the 2015 incident that killed Carol Glover and that 2009 Fort Totten station train crash that killed 9 people and injured lots more. And so I think people across our region, residents in D.C. and all the visitors to the District of Columbia rely on Metro Rail to provide a safe commute. And everyone who uses the system has to have confidence and understand that WMATA's leadership prioritizes the workplace culture of rider safety and, frankly, of employee safety as well.
We invited General Manager Paul Wiedefeld to join us today. He was unable to do so. We will have him on an upcoming show. But Tom Sherwood.
Mr. Council Member, thanks for being here today. The audit of the Rail Operations Center called it a toxic workplace. It said safety, personnel issues, mistreatment of employees, you name it. This audit said it was bad. David Horner, who is a federal government Department of Transportation member of Metro, suggested that Metro Rail System be shut down until the Rail Operations Center is actually functioning the way it should be. Would you like to see, or I know you wouldn't like to see, but would you agree with maybe shutting down the Metro Rail System until we know who's running it?
Well, I think it's going to be difficult to shut down the Metro Rail System. I understand the concerns. As I mentioned earlier, this notion of a toxic environment needs to be remedied immediately. But the idea that you could shut down Metro Rail, to me, given how many people rely on it. I mean, you've got residents who depend on Metro Rail to get to and from work. You've got businesses that depend on WMATA as well. And I think, frankly, as we continue to experience, Tom, this global pandemic, the success of our local economy in many ways is tied to the success of Metro. And so
you're being way too reasonable.
We need to put a toxic work environment needs to be addressed immediately. I wouldn't want to work in it. And when I hear the concerns that have been raised by employees, which I get, many of my friends I know work at Metro, and there's no shortage of people who reach out to our offices to complain about the conditions there. We know about the history of some of the safety issues that are there. We've got to make the necessary investments, and it's important for people to understand that those investments require a good deal from the District of Columbia as well as our regional partners and the federal government, for that matter, to make sure that the operations are happening safely and that there's not a toxic work environment. That's just simply unacceptable.
On top of the audit, General Manager Paul Wiedefeld announced on Wednesday that it is short more than $200 million. That could mean further service cuts, other measures. The pandemic has meant drastic reductions in fare revenue for Metro, which is quickly depleting its federal relief funds. Do you see a way out of this budget debacle, or should riders brace themselves for longer waits and earlier closing times if the system isn't shut down altogether?
Longer waits and earlier closing times does not inspire confidence. I just talked about how many people rely on Metro. And they're going through their federal funds. But they need more federal funds. I think it's clear. I think Metro needs more federal funds, as well as the district and jurisdictions across the country. So the federal government really needs to get its act together to make sure that those funds are forthcoming. But my expectation is that the board are going to take the necessary steps to make decisions that ensure a balanced budget and without compromising safety. And so they need additional federal funds, but they also need to make some tough decisions to ensure that they can balance the budget. And that's important.
Tom Sherwood.
Let's run through a couple of quick political questions. Attorney General Carl Racine says he'll run for a third term in 2022. I've been told that if he doesn't run for attorney general again, that you will run for attorney general in 2022. Your Ward 5 seat is up that year. Are you considering that if Carl Racine runs for mayor or does something else?
Tom, you gotta check your sources, man. I don't know where you're getting all this stuff. I hear that question all the time. You know, do I want to run for something else besides Ward 5? Look, I've got the best job that anybody can ask for.
Well, that's a yes or no.
People who it's not. Tom, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. I think people come to me and they ask that question because they appreciate, you know, some of the things that I've been able to do, you know, around criminal justice reform. They look at the work that I've
done. Yeah, you've
been
elected with 70% of the vote. You're very popular in Ward 5. This could be an opportunity. No one would criticize you for wanting maybe to step into a new job. But you will be in the council
as with any decision of that magnitude that I make about whether I have anything to offer the District of Columbia in a different position, I'm going to make that decision, you know, by consulting my family, you know, my wife and my
good.
Kids
on
and
that same subject. Residents. On that same subject, people in Ward 5 are telling me directly that Harry Thomas Jr., the former council member, has said that if you run for some other position, mayor or attorney general in 2022, he will run for the Ward 5 seat again. You know, he spent time in prison for his taking government money for himself. He's apologized for that. He's trying to straighten out his life. Would you think it was acceptable for Harry Thomas Jr. to run for the Ward 5 seat if you were not running for it?
Listen, I believe in second chances. So let me be clear about that. I believe in second chances. But I also believe that ultimately the voting public decides that. They decided when I ran in 2012 that they wanted, you know, new, fresh leadership, somebody who could come down and get work done immediately. And we've been able to do that. And so I think Ward 5 is really a smart electorate. They really pay attention to issues. Trust me, I know I get concerns from them in every shape and form.
Only got about 30 seconds left.
It's premature.
I
think it's premature
to
decide.
But before Kojo cuts us off, there are 24 people running for that large seat that David Grosso is giving up. Are you endorsing anyone in that race, that large race?
I've got some people in there who I've spoken to who I think are highly capable. But I'm not endorsing
yet.
Anybody. I think the
not yet.
No, I'm not endorsing anybody. No, not yet.
Got to take a short break. Yet. Our guest is Kenyon McDuffie, D.C. Council Member representing Ward 5. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. Our guest is Kenyon McDuffie. He's a D.C. council member representing Ward 5. And Anita has called. I don't know if Anita is disgruntled, but Anita does identify as living in Ward 5 and is now on the air. Anita, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. No, I have a simple concern and a question about the fire hydrants in Ward 5. There seem to be many of them that have been out of commission or out of service for years. And I'm wondering if those are going to be addressed.
Councilmember McDuffie?
They absolutely should have already been addressed, and I appreciate you raising the concern, and we'll make sure that we reach out to D.C. Water to address those immediately. I will tell you, I've been in communication with D.C. Water's leadership both yesterday and today after the heavy downpours that we got yesterday. We saw some unfortunate flooding experienced in parts of Ward 5. And so my office has been engaging with DC Water fairly extensively over the last 24 hours to make sure that we address these issues proactively. And so as it relates to fire hydrants, we will bring that up and make sure that they're checking them as they should already be doing.
Tom Sherwood had speculated about whether you might be running for attorney general at some point. It serves to remind us that you are a lawyer and a former prosecutor, former chair of the council's Judiciary and Public Safety Committee. So I got to ask, what are your thoughts on the recent killing of 18-year-old Dion Kay by a Metropolitan Police officer? And are you a proponent of what's known as defunding the police?
Well, I'll say, Kojo, first, I extend my condolences to Dion Kay's family and all of his loved ones. I had an opportunity to speak with Dion's mom, Natasha, and frankly, one of the things that she wanted me to share was that that still frame image of Dion holding what appears to be something in his hand should not and does not represent the entirety of who he was. And so I wanted to make sure I shared that. That I'll say, you know, when it comes to defunding the police, Kojo, I think this is really tied, less to simply eliminating, the Metropolitan Police Department. There's some people who believe in that. I don't believe that we need to eliminate the Metropolitan Police Department, but I believe that we need to go farther than we've already gone in terms of scaling down aspects of MPD's budget and taking those resources and making those investments in the people and those communities that are being over-policed. So when I think about Dion Kay and scores of people, perhaps like Dion Kay, young folks who are in the District of Columbia, and I don't want to assign this to Dion, but there are a lot of kids and young adults who don't have hope, Kojo, who don't see a future for themselves in this city. And when we discuss, the gun violence and that culture of gun violence, we have to talk about, systemic racism and institutional bias. And frankly, what it's like for children who have to grow up with the daily trauma of seeing, hearing gunshot sounds and seeing yellow tape and bloodstained streets. We're not making any excuses for people who commit crimes because they should be held accountable. But the reality is there are thousands of people in the District of Columbia who live with the fear and uncertainty, of being in poverty. All right. And we've got to address that. And when I see people call for defunding the police, they're saying that we need to make sure that we're looking at the Metropolitan Police Department's budget, which is well over $500 million, and only giving MPD the resources that they need to do their jobs, but that we take additional resources and make those investments in those communities and take approaches like the one that I champion with the NEAR Act, the Neighborhood Engagement Achieved Results Act, where we're taking a public health-based approach to crime prevention and intervention. And arming people with the resources that they need, the skills to be employed so that they can, make money and take care of themselves and their families. I think when you give people hope, you give them opportunity, they're less likely to be engaged in the sorts of violent crime that we're seeing in the District of Columbia.
Tom Sherwood.
Council member, back in June, you were upset when Police Chief Newsom complained that the council had, quote, completely abandoned the police officers. You stopped short of calling for his resignation. Have you talked with him since then? Have you tried to see what his point of view is? Or do you support the chief? Do you think he should step down?
I was extremely disappointed in the chief's response. I asked him some very pointed questions during oversight regarding the Metropolitan Police Department, how officers respond, and frankly, as people continue to talk about MPD's role in the protests that are occurring downtown, I'm encouraging people to look at how people are policing in our communities across the District of Columbia. I know some very, very thoughtful and quality police officers in the Metropolitan Police Department. I would venture to say that that's the case for many of the police officers. But there are some who don't get the proper training, who frankly show up way too often in certain communities, who create the friction and the antagonistic relationship that exists between the Metropolitan Police Department.
Do you need to change the police job, the police chief? Excuse me. Do you need to change the police chief in order to achieve the sensitivity that you're talking about?
I'll tell you what. I think it's important that we always look at the police chief and the leadership of the Metropolitan Police Department. On the other hand, I think there's a culture that exists that in the Metropolitan Police Department, where it doesn't inspire the sort of confidence with people in our neighborhoods. Community policing doesn't happen the way that it should. As you mentioned, Tom, I am a former prosecutor, but I'm also a former United States Department of Justice civil rights trial attorney, and I've investigated police departments for patterns of practice of misconduct, and I've seen quality policing. I've consulted with police professionals and know what it looks like.
Thank you. I know we don't have a little bit of time. Police Chief Newsom was on the Kojo Show last Politics Hour last week. I asked him if he was going to retire as chief. He's been on the force since 89. He said that he would be the chief as long as the people wanted him. But are you just not ready yet to say whether he should consider stepping down? You're obviously not interested in firing him, or you wouldn't
If Police Chief Newsom stepped down, I would not be disappointed. And frankly, I think if the council were to vote for a police chief.
Wait a minute. Here's Greg in Brooklyn. We wanted to get Ward 5 callers. Here's Greg. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, council member. This is Greg. I live in Brooklyn, and I see a lot of development by the Brooklyn Metro, by the Rhode Island Metro. I've heard rumors of Brooklyn Manor being redeveloped. How do we make sure that the same problems that have happened in Shaw, U Street, pushing out a lot of our long-term residents, that that doesn't happen here in Ward 5?
We ensure that it doesn't happen in Ward 5 by looking at economic development through the lens of equity. We ensure that the economic development that occurs across the District of Columbia is community-driven, and that people who are doing the development aren't making the decisions for people who live in these communities. And so I think it's important to approach economic development in a way that is balanced, that empowers individuals who live in these neighborhoods. We don't want to see over the next 10 to 15 years what we've seen on the prior 15 to 20 years, where thousands of District of Columbia residents have been displaced because we've not been thoughtful enough in how we've developed the city. You know, a lot of what I've done has prioritized housing affordability. It's making sure that the opportunities happen both with multifamily, but also with home ownership. I think if you put in context how this city, if you look at this city on a broad scope, you see that it's one of the most racially segregated cities when it comes to our housing. And we can't simply, do the same thing that we've been doing and expect a different result. We've got to be smarter and more thoughtful about how we approach economic development. And we've got to have housing that is available for people across income levels. We can't continue to concentrate poverty. We've got to make sure that we're more thoughtful in this. And if you look at what we've been able to do in the District of Columbia and some of the things that I want to do, with economic development, giving more opportunities to minority developers, making sure that that you have people who can make investments and actually have equity in some of the developments that occur in their own neighborhoods. I think this is the types of things that people want to see, and they want their government to really be champions for them.
Tom Sherwood, we only have about a minute left.
Ooh, well, I'm going to do a Ward 5 constituent issue. Rhode Island Avenue, the 600 block, the underpass there. I think when I was 10 years old, I did a story for Channel 4 News about the flooding of Rhode Island Avenue Northeast, the 600 block. It's a terrible situation there. Why hasn't that roadway been fixed?
You only have about 30 seconds left, Mr. Councilman.
I'll keep it short. We've invested billions. I have been on DC Water since I got in office. You all remember the derechos from 2012.
We only have 30 seconds. Why hasn't it been fixed?
It's because DC Water is currently working on a Clean Rivers project on Rhode Island Avenue, and there's open construction sites along Rhode Island Avenue, and I'm being told that that could have contributed to what happened yesterday. It needs to be fixed. It's a 100-year-old problem, and it's better than it had been, but people should not still be experiencing flooding, period.
Kenyon McDuffie is a DC council member representing Ward 5. Council member McDuffie, thank you so much for joining us.
And thanks for having me, Kojo.
Next up, Majority Leader of the Virginia Senate, Dick Saslaw. I'm Kojo Nambi. Welcome back. Our guest now is Dick Saslaw. He's the majority leader of the Virginia Senate. He's a Democrat and he represents Fairfax. Senator Saslaw, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kojo. I appreciate it.
Tom Sherwood, before we get directly to questions for the senator, both the Senate Majority Leader, you, and, well, all three of us were here back 19 years ago on September 11, 2001, when, among other places in New York, the Twin Towers, the Pentagon came under attack. And so now we're having a remembrance of that event at which 125 people in the building were killed, all 64 people on the plane were killed. But this year, Tom Sherwood, something of a scaled back remembrance because of the pandemic.
It's unfortunate. I was in Orlando when 9/11 happened, and I drove through the night to get back to town. And in the middle of the night, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, I saw the flames at the Pentagon before I went to work the next day. But because of COVID virus, it's not a ceremony. The remembrance today is very scaled back. There was an early morning ceremony. A huge American flag was unveiled. Family members of those who died in that horrible event are visiting the site today. It's closed to the media and to the other people, the public. And it's just a solemn remembrance. Next year, it's just very difficult to believe. Next year will be the 20th anniversary. I hope that next year we'll be able to properly mark this terrible occasion, both here, Pennsylvania, and New York.
I think we all do. Senator Saslaw?
What I was going to say was, you know, I was in the service station business for many, many years with stations in Maryland and Virginia. And one of them is at Braddock and Backlick Road. And my office for the other stations was there, so I spent a good bit of my time there. I was in the office, and when I walked out, I'd known about the two buildings in New York. One of the service station attendants, outside attendant, says to me, "Did you see that?" I said, "What?" He said, "There was a plane that just flew over here." He said, "I've never seen a plane that low flying that fast." That turned out to be the plane that hit the Pentagon, went right over my station.
Yeah, these are very difficult memories for just about everyone in these parts. As I said, our guest is Dick Saslaw, Majority Leader of the Virginia Senate. Mr. Senator, the General Assembly, where Democrats hold a majority in both houses, is in the midst of a special session. It drew up an agenda that includes the Commonwealth's budget shortfall, police reform, and pandemic-related bills. But before we get to those issues, let's first talk about how this session is different than past ones. The whole General Assembly is not gathered in the State House as it would be in normal times. Where and how is this special session taking place for the House of Delegates and the Senate?
The situation has become complicated as a result of that. I think had it not been for the pandemic, we would have been meeting anyways with respect to the budget and probably social justice issues. But we would have both been at the Capitol, and I think by now it would have been done because we'd have been there exchanging bills 5 days a week. It hasn't worked that way. The House, is meeting virtually, so the communication is not what it would be under a normal set of circumstances, and that's what slowed the whole process down. We meet at the Science Museum, which is several miles from the Capitol, and we've been meeting there 2 to 3 days a week. Now, we're going to be holding meetings next week, committee meetings, that'll be virtual. But we will be in Richmond Tuesday afternoon. We go into session at 4 o'clock. And then Wednesday morning, and there'll be committee meetings on the phone and there during that time. But anyway, and then Wednesday morning, we go back in session at 10 o'clock.
Tom Sherwood.
And by then, we hope to have all the Senate bills, with the exception of the budget, clear to the Senate.
Mr. Majority Leader, thank you. Normally, these special sessions last one day or just a couple of days. Do you have a sine die, a certain date that you intend to adjourn before I ask you a policy question?
No, we don't. That's been part of the problem. We should be finished with the Senate bills this coming week. In other words, by Wednesday, the House would be finished with all of their bills. We will have less bills than we started out with, and hopefully we can clear their bills by sometime the following week, and definitely no later than the week after that. And
You talked about how difficult it is to just communicate with people that you normally would do so in the state capitol. I've been told, I've called around Richmond because I haven't been down there for a while. I'm told one of the issues is that the Senate is far more, while it may be progressive in some ways, is far more conservative or moderate than the House. and that you personally are not getting along too well with House Speaker Eileen Fillercorn.
That's not true at all. Eileen is a good friend of mine.
Well, good friends can have serious debates over issues, but
you're always going to have debates over issues.
But these police issues are going into the 2021 election when all 100 House seats are up and you're running the candidates for governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you this. We sent an awful lot of bills during the 2020 session over there that dealt with a variety of topics that you would call pretty progressive. And my understanding was about 16, 18 of them were killed. So that's not necessarily so. On who's what, ideologically. Depends on the issue.
Well, let's talk specifically about police reform. Just yesterday, the Senate passed a massive package of bills in response to protests against police killings. It now has to pass the House of Delegates. But tell us a little bit about what's included in that reform package.
In that reform package, amongst some of the things, we prohibit no-knock warrants, okay? We ban sex with individuals arrested by law enforcement officers. We're going to prohibit the hiring of officers fired or re-signed during the use of force investigation. We definitely have expanded the decertification procedure for law enforcement officers, and they can't be rehired if they lose that certification. We ban chokeholds and strangleholds unless officer feels his life is at stake and necessarily prove it. The officer's life is not at stake when the guy's face down on the concrete with his hands handcuffed behind him. It's requiring them to attempt to de-escalate any situation prior to the use of force. They got to require warrant. We're going to require warnings before shots are fired. The law enforcement officer is going to have to exhaust all other means prior to using deadly force. They're going to create a duty by the other law enforcement officers on the scene to intervene if a police officer acts out of hand. Okay. We're going to prohibit the shooting at moving vehicles unless it's to save your life or the life of other people.
Okay.
And about 38% of the police forces in Virginia are nationally certified. We're going to essentially require them all to get certified.
Nationally certified. There's Chris in Falls Church who'd like to comment on that. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm calling to congratulate Senator Sasslaw for passing that omnibus bill with the criminal justice reforms. We need it, especially because they're here in Northern Virginia. A motorist was stopped on I-95 who had done nothing wrong and was terribly, terribly beaten and horribly mistreated by an officer of the law, and for no reason. And there was no... there was no reason to stop him. There was no contraband of any kind found in his car. He was not an impaired driver, nothing. And so we have to be able to discipline those unfortunate officers who go too far.
And you're going to be able to do that if they violate these provisions.
Well, one police reform measure that failed to pass the Senate dealt with qualified immunity for police officers. Why was it harder to pass than others?
Let's talk about that. Okay?
Yes, please.
Senator Locke's bill, 5030, will help thousands and thousands of people. Thousands. Every year in the state of Virginia. The qualified immunity bill might help a dozen. Okay? Might help a dozen cases. What we've got in this bill, in Senator Locke's bill, you violate. Let me just make sure you understand this. You violate the chokehold provision. You violate shooting in a moving vehicle, and your life or the life of someone else wasn't involved. You didn't issue a warning before using deadly force. You didn't attempt to de-escalate the situation, and you as another officer didn't intervene in a mess. You lose. Let me repeat this. You lose the claim of qualified immunity if you break this. And if you break the other provisions that are in Senate Bill 5030, you lose the qualified immunity.
Could you explain for our listeners what qualified immunity is?
We've essentially knocked out 50% of the cases where qualified immunity is going to be used.
Okay, but exactly what is qualified immunity?
Well, it enables them to say that, you know, because of the circumstances, we're exempt. We're police officers, we're exempt. Let me explain why that bill didn't make it. First off, on that committee of 15 members, there are 9 Democrats and 6 Republicans. Of the 9 Democrats, 5 are trial lawyers, okay? And essentially all 5 want us to drastically alter qualified immunity. 4 of the 5 lawyers, 4 of the 5 lawyers who would essentially be filing these suits said this bill was not ready for prime time, okay? And these are all progressive. These are all progressive Democrats who are trial lawyers. You know, to simply say, use the term excessive force with no definition, no legal definition, you're going to have big problems, they said. There was one other term. You know, you can't go into court with no legal definitions of a crime.
Okay, so that's why that measure didn't pass. Tom Sherwood.
Yeah, now, and let me tell you what we're going to do. The chairman of the committee, John Edwards, is going to appoint a subcommittee that will begin work probably within, as soon as we get out of the special session, in trying to put together something which can successfully deal with the situation of the remaining situations of qualified immunity. We took care of about half of that in Senate Bill 5030.
Tom Sherwin.
Mr. Majority Leader, I think the state, Virginia, which I covered some years ago when you were a young man, is should get credit for addressing all of these long simmering issues. But I want to ask you about one specific one.
Sure.
One provision would establish citizen review boards in all the jurisdictions around the state. The Virginia Association.
It leaves it up to local option, Tom.
What? Okay.
It's local
Virginia
option.
Association. Okay. That's the Senate version, right? Is that in the House also? What's the House have a local option?
I don't know if the House is local.
Okay, I don't think so. What I'm going to say is the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police, the Virginia Sheriff's Association, the Virginia State Police Association, and the Virginia Fraternal Order of Police have acknowledged that some reforms need to be done, but they don't want individual citizen review boards around the state. It's your view, the Senate's view, that these will be optional, not required.
Yes, the local governments will have that option. And the review boards, at least in the Senate version, memory serves me correct, they cannot terminate someone. First of all, they couldn't do it in the sheriff's office because that's a constitutional office, not under the control of local government.
I don't know if Kojo will let me. I want to switch back to state politics. Folks are lining up to run for governor next year. The lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax, this week announced that he filed today to run. Are you supporting any particular person? And what do you think of Justin Fairfax running?
Yes, I'm supporting Terry McAuliffe, and Fairfax has a right to run if he wants.
Do you think that the allegations of sexual misconduct, two allegations of sexual misconduct, are going to make it difficult for him to win, or what is your objection?
It's certainly not a plus in a campaign. I think everybody knows that.
The House of Delegates this week approved a bill that would make it easier for cities and counties to remove Confederate monuments, Mr. Majority Leader. Many monuments in Virginia have already come down in past months. What will this bill do, and will the Senate follow with similar legislation?
Yeah, I would think that would make it through the Senate. Some of the local governments in far southwest Virginia probably won't be removing too many. In your urban I-95/64 corridor, a lot of them will come down, and it's quite an irritant. to an awful lot of our citizenry. And keep in mind, you know, when the Washington Post did that story a couple years ago, several years ago after the incident in Charlottesville, I think it was Robert E. Lee V, who's the great-great-grandson of the general, said the family wants the monuments down.
Yeah, I do remember that. Our guest is Dick Saslaw. He's majority leader of the Virginia Senate. Let's talk for a minute about the felony case against State Senator Louise L. Lucas, a Democrat from Portsmouth. Portsmouth police brought the charge of conspiracy to topple a Confederate monument, a charge the Washington Post editorial board this week characterized as, quoting here, a preposterous example of rogue local police making a mockery of justice. How do you view this case?
They pretty much reflected my opinion.
Okay. You feel that it's a preposterous example of rogue police?
I have never heard, in all my years in office, Gojo, and Tom, I've never heard of a situation being brought like that where they bypassed the Commonwealth Attorney. Now, the Commonwealth Attorney and everybody else connected with the law enforcement knows she committed no crime. You know, she talked to the chief of police at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. She was gone from the premises. And first off, the chief certainly had no obligation to listen to her. She's not a city official. And she was gone from the premises for 8 hours before that whole mess occurred. Kindly tell me how somebody who's 8 hours off the premises incited a riot.
Well, I can't. But I can change the subject. Governor Ralph Northam shared his own priorities when he called this special session, including $85 million to expand broadband and $15 million for historically black colleges and universities. He says they are important to diminish inequities across the state. Will the General Assembly fund these priorities?
I think we'll fund a good bit of it, yeah. And we really do have to do something. And where it shows up, Gojo, is in this now that so many of these kids are learning, you know, through virtual classrooms. And when you live in an area that doesn't have broadband, that's a pretty difficult task.
Virginia's also facing a big hole in its budget due to the massive economic hit as a result of the pandemic.
Yeah.
What's the General Assembly doing to sew it up?
I got good news and I got bad news.
Okay.
The bad news is, you know, we projected the possibility of $2.7 billion shortfall. We just got August numbers, and they've all come in way above what we were projecting.
That's the good news.
With respect to revenues. And it's not back where it needs to be, but we may be able to restore. We won't be able to restore a tremendous amount of money now because, you know, we're not like the federal government. We don't have a printing press. So that budget has to be in balance. But we may be able to restore a lot of the cuts that we are in the process of making or have had to make with respect to what we had planned to do for FY21 and 22. Now, having said that, there are some priorities that the Senate will have, and we've identified a few possible savings in the budget where we may be able to find the money to do that. But it's not going to be a lot. It'll be some, but it's not going to be a lot.
Tom Sherwood?
Two quick things, Mr. Majority Leader. One, I know the General Assembly has set aside $2 million to make it to allow elections boards around the state to send out prepaid voting ballots or absentee ballots.
That's if requested, yeah.
If requested, that's a good thing. But let me ask you also, the attorneys general of Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia have all sued the federal EPA over the Chesapeake Bay, saying that EPA is against Pennsylvania and New York. How important is the Chesapeake Bay to the Virginia economy?
It's very important because down in the Tidewater area and along the upper peninsulas, fishing is a major industry.
And of course, Norfolk. I'm sorry, go ahead, Kojo.
Here is Rob in Arlington. Rob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hey, Kojo, Tom, thank you for taking my call. Real quick for Mr. Senate Leader, are you guys going to relook at any further, stronger gun control legislation. We didn't get everything we wanted last time. Thank you.
Well, you got 9 out of the 10 bills. Not during the special session, but we're probably going to take a look at semi-automatic military-style weapons again, next year. What Delegate Levine's bill would have done was, and I voted for it in committee, it would have banned future sales of the AR-15. And we may wind up looking at that again in 2021.
Thank you very much for your call. Let's go back into your history a little bit with Barney in Strasburg, Virginia. Barney, your turn.
Senator Saslaw, if I'm not mistaken, you went to Woodrow Wilson in D.C.
That's correct. I sure did. Warren Buffett and did, too.
And what's your
opinion? He was much more successful.
He was a lot more successful than I have to admit that.
What's your question,
as did, Warren Buffett go to Wilson, and as did a lot of other people. But the question is, what's your opinion of this move to change the name of Wilson? Because it's perceived that Wilson.
Look, you're going to find flaws with everybody. His segregationist views. Remember, he didn't own slaves, but his segregationist views were certainly not helpful. He did a lot of good things. He promoted, the woman's right to vote. He developed the League of Nations, which ultimately evolved into the United Nations. His views on segregation were deplorable, but I'm generally not for changing the name. But it's not, I'm leaving that up to the people, that live in the city. That's
Tom,
their call.
Tom Sherwood, we only have about a minute left.
The Vice President Mike Pence was at VMI this week saying how much President Trump reveres the military. You've heard the news stories about his criticism of the military in private, Bob Woodward's book. What are you seeing in Virginia as a purple state going into next year's presidential election and Trump's troubles?
Well, let me tell you, if he reveres the military anymore, they're in big trouble. I'm glad the voters didn't revere me the way he revered the military. Quite frankly, the comments that were published in that Atlantic paper are pretty deplorable. And I don't think there's anybody in their right mind that doesn't believe that, considering the remarks he made publicly about Senator McCain and his treatment of McCain.
And that was the Jeffrey Goldberg article in Atlantic Magazine. I said yes. Woodward's book. That was something else that attacked the president.
Right. Biden should carry Virginia by 10 to 15 points.
Okay, and I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Mr. Majority Leader, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, Kojo, thank you. Okay?
Okay.
Today's show was produced by Lauren Marco. Coming up Monday, acclaimed young adult author Jason Reynolds joins Kojo for Kids to talk about his books, what's going on in kids' lives today, and his new video in which he performs his poem called For Everyone. Writing it, he says, was like constructing a personal amusement park. And finally, nearly 7,000 people in the Washington region have died of the coronavirus. On an upcoming Kojo show, we will remember local lives lost, and we need your help. Has someone close to you passed away from COVID-19? Share your story with us. Go to kojoshow.org and click on the banner that says Remembering the Lives Lost. Until then, have a wonderful weekend. Any plans, Tom Sherwood?
I just think recognizing 9/11 all weekend will be the right thing to do.
And everyone, stay safe and thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nand.
Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Richard Cunningham, Julie Devenbrock, Kurt Gardiner, Sydney Grannon, Lauren Marco, and Inez Renike. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Schrobstorf. Our engineer is Natalie Yerv-Lipker. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.